You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So last week, we were looking at the anointing of Saul. And if you recall how that ended, Samuel was announcing to the nation of Israel that Saul was going to be the new king. And Saul is hiding in the baggage. And we're told in 1 Samuel 10, verse 24 and 27, that Samuel said to all the people, "This is the man the Lord has chosen as your king. No one in all Israel is like him." And all the people shouted, "Long live the king." But there were some scoundrels who complained, "How can this man save us?" And they scorned him and refused to bring him gifts, but Saul ignored him. So, part of the reason why they were maybe a little skeptical is that Saul came from the smallest tribe in Israel. And so they said, you know, why would God choose such an insignificant tribe to bring about the king of Israel, the savior of our nation? Anyway, in 1 Samuel 11, we get maybe the first account of Saul in action as king. We're told in verse 1, about a month later, King Nahash of Ammon led his army against the Israelite town of Jabesh. But all the citizens of Jabesh asked for peace. "Make a treaty with us and we'll be your servants," they pleaded. So just even the mere threat that the Ammonites were going to attack Israel, they concede right away. And they're like, "Listen, we'll do whatever you want. We'll make a treaty with you. We'll become your servants." "All right then," Nahash said, "but only on one condition. I will gouge out the right eye of every one of you as a disgrace to all Israel." So obviously the Ammonites didn't want just the Israelites to concede and become their vassals. But they also wanted to humiliate them. And we know, too, from ancient accounts that this sort of stuff happened where people would be maimed. They would cut off somebody's right arm or all the people's right arms as a way to demonstrate their superiority and military prowess. Well, they say in verse 3, "Give us 7 days to send messengers throughout Israel," replied the elders of Jabesh. "But if no one comes to save us, we'll agree to your terms." When the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and told the people about their plight, everyone broke into tears. Saul had been plowing a field with his oxen, and when he returned to town, he asked, "What's the matter? Why is everybody crying?" And so they told him about the message from Jabesh. Interesting that Saul, even though he had been anointed king, he was still pretty humble. He was plowing a field with his oxen when he was told about this report. Then the Spirit of God came powerfully upon Saul, and he became very angry. And we're told that Saul compels all the men of Israel to fight against the Ammonites under the threat that he's going to actually kill their herds if they don't participate. So the men of Jabesh told their enemies, "Tomorrow we're going to come out to you and we'll give you whatever you wish." But before dawn the next morning, Saul arrived and he launched a surprise attack against the Ammonites and slaughtered them the whole morning. Then the people exclaimed to Samuel, "Now, where are those men who said, why should Saul rule over us? Bring them here, and then we're going to kill him." But Saul replied, "No one will be executed today, for today the Lord has rescued Israel." So this is Saul's first military campaign, and he saw tremendous success. A few things to note. One is that Saul, as I mentioned earlier, he had humble beginnings. That even though he was the king of Israel, he was still plowing his field. But another thing to note as well is that we already start to see something about Saul's character. That instead of persuading the men to fight, he compels them through fear. So we want to look at Saul's life and we want to ask three questions because we know the outcome, that Saul ultimately discredited himself as king. And so we want to know, how did he fail? Why did he fail? And how can we escape the fate of Saul? So the first question, how did he fail? 1 Samuel 13, the beginning of this is that Saul's campaign, he's fighting against the Philistines because the Israelites are under occupation. The Philistines had subdued them at some point. And Saul gives Jonathan a detachment. Jonathan is his son, of troops. And Jonathan actually defeats the garrison of the Philistines that's in Israelite occupation or territory. So the Philistines mustered this mighty army to regain control of their garrison. And this is where we pick up in the narrative. Verse 7. Meanwhile, Saul stayed at Gilgal, and his men were trembling with fear. Saul waited there 7 days for Samuel, as Samuel had instructed him earlier. But Samuel didn't come. Saul realized that his troops were rapidly slipping away. So normally in Israel, they did the morning sacrifices and the evening sacrifices. And apparently Samuel, the prophet, had said, listen, I want you to wait until I offer the sacrifices before we go out into battle. But as he's waiting on Samuel to come, he starts to notice that all of his troops are starting to desert his army. And so he demanded, bring me the burnt offering and the peace offerings. And Saul sacrificed the burnt offering himself. And just as Saul was finishing with the burnt offering, Samuel arrives. Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul replied, I saw my men scattering from me, and you didn't arrive, and you, like you said you would, and the Philistines at Michmash were ready for battle. And so he panics and runs out ahead of the Lord, and we're told he commits a grave error by sacrificing to the Lord. In the Old Testament, the only people who could actually sacrifice were the priests, and we know that Saul was not a priest of God. So he says to Samuel, I said, the Philistines are ready to march out against us at Gilgal, and I haven't even asked for the Lord's help. So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering myself before you came. Samuel exclaimed, how foolish! You have not kept the commandment of God the Lord your God had gave you. Had you kept it, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. Now, notice that the excuses that Saul gives are laced with fear. He says, first of all, his soldiers who are scattering, Samuel who did not come at the set time, and the Philistines who were assembling at Michmash were putting him under tremendous pressure to act and do something. And so his act of disobedience was based on his fear and insecurity that God was not going to come through. Well, Samuel says this, but now your kingdom must end, for the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. The Lord has already appointed him to be the leader of his people. And so already God is signaling to Saul, you're done. So Saul's troops, in the meantime, dwindled to just 600 people. So it was a small detachment. And meanwhile, we're told in 1 Samuel 14, one day Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come, let's go over to where the Philistines have their outposts. But Jonathan didn't tell his father what he was doing. So nobody really knew except for him and his armor bearer what he was going to go out and do. Verse 4, to reach the Philistine outposts, Jonathan had to go down between two rocky cliffs. And he said to his armor bearer, let's go across to the outposts of the Philistines. Perhaps the Lord will help us, for nothing can hinder the Lord. He can win a battle whether he has many warriors or a few. So a few things. You know, when you look at Jonathan's declaration to his armor bearer, he says, perhaps the Lord will help us. He doesn't just presume that God is going to come through, even though he knows that God has the power to do so. And the source of his confidence then is that the Lord is powerful, and he's seen this before. That God has come through, but also God in the Old Testament had promised, or in the Old Testament times, promised that Israel would occupy this promised land. And so he says, nothing can hinder the Lord. He can win a battle whether there are many warriors or few. The New English Translation says, nothing can prevent the Lord from delivering, whether by many or by few. So the Lord is not limited by our imagination. You know, that's part of the problem, I think, when we are trying to step out in faith for God, is that we are limited by what we think and can imagine God doing in situations. Well, verse 7 says, do what you think is best, the armor bearer replied. I'm with you completely, whatever you decide. Notice the contrast between the armor bearer and his response to Jonathan compared to Saul and the response that his soldiers have to him. They're fleeing because the morale is low, and the only reason most of them are there is because they're being compelled by fear and threats from Saul. All right, then, Jonathan told him, we'll cross over and let them see us. If they say to us, stay where you are or we'll kill you, then we'll stop. We won't go up to them. But if they say, come up and fight, then we'll go up. That will be the Lord's sign that he will help us defeat them. So apparently he must have consulted with God on this, right? I don't know how he came up with this plan. But it's a really interesting plan because it defied all military logic. First of all, he would give up the elements of surprise. He would show up and be like, hey, that's not a good battle plan. Secondly, he would retreat if the Philistines abandoned their superior tactical advantage being on top of a mountain. So he's like, if they say, wait there, we're coming down to you, he's like, in that case, we're going to withdraw. But he would attack only if they challenged him to scale this sheer rock wall with his armor bearer. Can you imagine this scene? They see him and his armor bearer, and they're like, why don't you come up here? And Jonathan's like, that's the Lord's sign. We need to climb this wall. Well, verse 11 through 14, when the Philistines saw them coming, they shouted, look, the Hebrews are crawling out of their holes. Then the men from the outpost shouted to Jonathan, come up here and we'll teach you a lesson. And they climbed up using both their hands and their feet, and the Philistines fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer, and they killed those who came behind them, and they killed some 20 men in all. So they just completely slaughtered this detachment of Philistines. Well, a panic breaks out in the Philistine camp, and Saul's lookouts actually see this vast Philistine army melting in every direction. And so Saul pursues them and brings backup and rushes into battle. Now, when the men were pressed to exhaustion that day, because Saul had placed them under an oath saying, let a curse fall on anyone who eats before evening, before I've had my full revenge on my enemies. So no one ate anything, even though they had found honeycomb on the ground in the forest. So Saul gave this decree out of nowhere. He says, nobody can eat. And even though there was plentiful food on the ground in the forest, he says too, before I have my full revenge on my enemies. Notice he doesn't say because the victory should be the Lord's, but he says, no, because I want revenge for how they've treated us. But Jonathan hadn't heard his father's command, and he dipped the end of his stick into a piece of honeycomb and ate the honey. And after he had eaten it, he felt refreshed. Actually, other translations say that his eyes brightened, right? So during the battle, you know, Saul consults the Lord as to whether or not they should pursue the Philistines throughout the night into the morning. But he gets no response. And so he's like, something's wrong. He infers that somebody in his camp must have sinned against the Lord. So he says in verse 39, I vow by the name of the Lord who rescued Israel that the sinner will surely die, even if it's my own son, Jonathan. Verse 43 and 44, when he discovers that Jonathan was the one who had eaten some of the honeycomb, he says, tell me what you have done. Saul demanded, I tasted a little bit of the honey. Does that deserve death? Saul said, yes, Jonathan, you must die. May God strike me and even kill me if you do not die for this. So, okay, where did this come from? The Old Testament says nothing about eating before battle. This was completely arbitrary. This is something that Saul came up with himself. Well, we're told in verse 45, when the people broke in, said to Saul, Jonathan has won this great victory for Israel. Should he die? Far from it. As surely as the Lord lives, not one hair of his head will be touched, for God helped him do a great deed today. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. Saul's threats were empty. His men had no respect for him. In fact, the people who they really, the person they really respected was Jonathan and the armor bearer. Now, when Saul had secured his grasp on Israel's throne, he fought against his enemies in every direction. Wherever he turned, he was victorious, and he performed great deeds and conquered the Amalekites, saving Israelite from all those who plundered them. So, despite his moral compromise, despite the fact that God had withdrawn the throne from him and his family, Saul was still seeing great success. And this is possible. You know, you may be interested or have devoted your life to serving God. And for some time, you might have moral compromise in your life, and God may still be using you. And you might conclude from that, you know what? I'm in there with God because he's using me powerfully, even though you haven't given yourself and your heart over to him. That you have created this separate life of compromise. And yet we see that the outcome of Saul's life was actually quite tragic. So 1 Samuel 15, God calls out Saul to face the Amalekites. And he says, I want you to go and destroy them because they were an existential threat to Israel. And two, we know that they were killing the Israelites as they were escaping from Egypt. And so God says, what I want you to do is I want you to destroy everything that they have as a form of judgment for the way that they have treated you and others. And so we're told after defeating the Amalekites in verse 9, Saul and his men spared Agag's life, the king, and kept the best of the sheep and goats, the cattle and the fat calves and the lambs, everything, in fact, that appealed to them. They destroyed whatever was worthless or of poor quality. Then the Lord said to Samuel, I'm sorry that I ever made Saul king, for he has not been loyal to me and has refused to obey my command. Samuel was so deeply moved when he heard this, that he cried out to the Lord all night. This has to be one of the saddest statements that God gives to us in the Old Testament, really maybe even in the Bible, that he felt sorry that he ever made Saul king. And so early the next morning, Samuel went to find Saul. Someone told him, Samuel went to the town of Carmel to set up a monument to himself. Then he went on to Gilgal. When Samuel finally found him, Saul greeted him cheerfully. May the Lord bless you, he said. I've carried out the Lord's command. He was so self-deceived at this point. Samuel said to Saul, stop. Listen to what the Lord has told me last night. Saul asked, what did he tell you? And Samuel told him, although you may think little of yourself, are you not the leader of the tribes of Israel? The Lord has anointed you the king over Israel. Why haven't you obeyed him? But I did obey the Lord, Saul insisted. My troops brought in the best of the sheep, goats, cattle, and plunder to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. But Samuel replied, what is more pleasing to the Lord, your burnt offerings and sacrifices, or your obedience to his voice? Listen, obedience is better than sacrifice, and submission is better than offering the fat of rams. So, this is the how behind why he failed. Let's talk about why he failed. You know, when we look at somebody like Saul, I think the root issue here is more than just disobedience. Because on a superficial level, you can see disobedience. You can see him and his arrogance building a monument to himself as the basis for his disqualification. But I think at the root of what's actually happening is that he was plagued by insecurity and fear. That was the character flaw that led to a lot of the problems and ultimately the disqualification of him as king. We read in verse 17, although you may think little of yourself, the Lord has anointed you king of Israel. You see right there, he says, although you think little of yourself. It's not that he was just this humble guy. It's that he was an insecure person. And because of that, he was a danger to Israel. You know, you hear people say stuff like, yeah, I'm just a really insecure person. As if it's a trivial thing. But stories like this tell us that deep insecurities can actually cause huge problems and can be extremely damaging. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not talking about like small insecurities that we have. Sometimes we say stuff like, yeah, I'm kind of insecure about the way I look, right? I would say that's more feeling self-conscious. Everybody feels self-conscious on some level. What we're talking about here is insecurity, which is this deep sense of feeling inadequate. And when you have that, when you're walking around with that deficit, that's a dangerous place to be. First of all, you see with Saul and those who are plagued by insecurity and fear that they try to draw people to themselves and not to God. That's especially true in Christian work. You know, think about the episode involving the honey. That was really a test of loyalty to Saul, not to God. Secondly, you're willing to use or hurt people that you care about most in order to prove yourself. You know, think about verse 39 in chapter 14 where he says, I vow by the name of the Lord who rescued Israel that the sinner will surely die, even if it's my own son Jonathan. He was so determined to establish himself that if anybody defied him, if anybody challenged him, even his own son, they would surely die. And you see this with deeply insecure people. They often turn against the very people that they love. They also use fear, intimidation, and manipulation to try to coerce the people around them. Later in 1 Samuel, we were told this story about his interaction with King David in chapter 18, verse 20 and 21, that Saul's daughter, Michal, was in love with David. And when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. He saw an opportunity. He says, I will give her to him, he thought, so that she may be a snare to him and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. And so Saul said to David, now you have a second opportunity to be my son-in-law. And so he used his daughter to manipulate David. and hopefully to try to gain control of him. You know, the other thing you see with people plagued by insecurity and fear is that they're jealous when others get the attention they feel like they deserve. You know, it wasn't lost on Saul that his son was seeing spectacular military success and everybody else around them saw it too. That might have been one of the reasons why he said, even if my son Jonathan disobeyed me, I'm going to kill him. You know, people plagued by insecurity and fear are furious when they stand in the shadow of others. Again, later in 1 Samuel 18, verse 7 and 8, the people started to praise David, and they danced and sang this song: Saul has slain the thousands, and David his tens of thousands. And Saul was very angry. This refrain displeased him greatly. You know, you might be thinking to yourself, you know, I'm not really that insecure. Let me ask you this. Do you feel a tinge of anger and resentment when others are like looking at you and they look past you and say, oh, he does a great job? Does that bother you? That's probably a sign that even though you're trying to ignore it, you're a deeply insecure person. You know, you're more likely to get into conflicts and fights because I'm not feeling heard, because I'm not being appreciated by the people around me, because I'm not getting my way. And so we get bitter, we get angry, and over time, over years, over decades, that bitterness, that anger, it starts to consume us. It destroys our relationships, it destroys us. Have you ever met people who have been bitter for decades? It's like everywhere they turn, there is this aggression that's trying to find a target. Wherever they turn. You know, I was talking to my son as he's getting a little bit older. I'm like, you know, you should learn how to defend yourself on a basic level. Right? I was like, listen, in the unlikely event you ever find yourself in a physical confrontation, you should at least know how to handle yourself, right? But the one thing I told him is the first line of defense is relational. You could talk your way out of situations and de-escalate them. But I said the other thing to notice, too, is that if you feel confident in your ability to defend yourself on a basic level, you're actually less likely to get into a fight. And the reason I told him that is because I said, the most insecure people are also the most dangerous. You know, when I was younger, I spent probably more than half of my teenage life in jail, in juvenile corrections facilities. And, you know, as I've reflected back on what happened, why did I get to that place in my life, I started to realize, you know, I wanted people to like me when I was really young. But I was just not very relational. I was antisocial. And so I would do these weird things to try to get attention from all of the people at school. And they would just be like, get out of here. Like, they were so annoyed with me for good reason. And so I thought to myself, if I can't get people to love me, then I just need to command their respect. And I thought the best way to get respect was to try to incite fear in them. And so I was fighting all the time because I wanted to prove myself. And so that's how that all started. And, you know, when you feel like you've got to prove something, you're going to find yourself in conflict in your life. Everywhere you turn. And the problem is you're going to be blaming everybody else for the conflict in your life and not realizing the common denominator is you. Everybody else seems to get along well with other people except for you. The other thing we see in Saul's life is impatience, that he was running out ahead of the Lord. That's what caused him to sacrifice instead of waiting for Samuel. Now, you might be saying again, you know, I don't really resonate with any of this because I'm a pretty secure person. Well, insecure people also like to project false confidence. And they do this because they're trying to make up for the deep insecurities that they feel in their lives. They want people to believe that they are confident and they know what they're doing, even though they're not so sure of themselves. And in many cases, this leads to things like self-deception. You know, that's what was happening with Saul, right? He was so deluded in his thinking, he thought that he was doing the Lord's command when he actually did the opposite of what God told him to do. And so self-deception is a clear sign that we're plagued by insecurity and fear because, you know, when you have your ego, your self-perception at stake, you're going to do anything and everything you can to try to protect that. And any information that comes in, any data that contradicts what you think you want to be, you're going to simply ignore that or try to bury it. You know, me and my wife and my kids, we go on these long road trips, 20 hours, sometimes 24 hours of driving, maybe 40, right? And as we're driving along, sometimes my wife will say, "What's that noise?" And I'm like, "What noise? I don't know. I don't know. Something doesn't sound right with the car." I'm like, "I don't think there's anything wrong," and I just turn up the radio, right? And then, of course, what happens? Things break down. And so I don't want to believe that there's something wrong, and so I try to find ways to ignore it. Think of another example. This is Air Florida Flight 90 back in the 80s. There was a case where as they were flying out from Washington, D.C., in the middle of winter in icy conditions, this plane crashed in the Potomac River, claiming the lives of hundreds of people. They discovered the flight recorder later, and they heard a cockpit discussion between the pilot and the co-pilot where the pilot was saying, "You know, I hate all this bureaucracy. We have to go through all these different checks. It's so stupid. I don't know why we have all of these different policies." And 50 minutes go by without them de-icing the plane. And so the co-pilot says, I'm seeing some readings here that make me a little uncertain about us taking off." And the pilot said, "Just, you know, forget the bureaucracy. I'm a good pilot. I know what I'm doing. Let's just take off." And what happened? His self-confidence, his self-deception in his own abilities led to a huge tragedy. You know, self-deception is really not the worst thing we do, but it's the reason why we do horrible things. It's the reason why we make really bad decisions. And that's exactly what happened with Saul. You know, you also find that people who are deeply insecure are unwilling to take responsibility. They just cannot imagine that the problem is them and what they have done. They have to blame other people. They make excuses, which also leads to bad decisions. Now, by contrast, you have Jonathan, who's bold and confident in the Lord. You know, think about this statement where he tells his attendant, he says, "Come, climb right behind me, for the Lord will help us defeat them." He's so bold, he's not afraid, even though it's just two against thousands. Well, we see that he's willing to take risks, that he's fearless, and he's also not entitled. He's not sure, so he says, "Perhaps the Lord will work for us." And you know, people followed him out of love and loyalty, not fear and compulsion. And he sought the Lord in his decisions, unlike Saul. So the last thing we want to look at is how can we escape the thing that destroyed Saul? Well, right there in verse 17, we have the answer. Where God says to Saul, "Although you may think little of yourself, are you not the leader of the tribes of Israel? The Lord has anointed the king of Israel." He says, even though you didn't deserve it, even though you were a nobody, I chose you because of my sovereignty and because of my grace. It wasn't because you're anything spectacular. It's because of who I am. And so we see then that, you know, Saul never took his security from God's unmerited love. That was the real root problem. He wanted to make something of himself. He wanted to be someone. But he wanted to do that apart from God. And it was because he was deeply insecure about who he was. You know, Edmund Clowney, who gave a sermon years back on Deuteronomy 7, verse 7 and 8, had a very interesting perspective on this passage. It says, "The Lord did not love you and choose you because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your ancestors that he brought you up out of Egypt with a mighty hand." Now, Clowney points out, he says, when you look at what God is saying here, it's a circular argument. Why does God love you? The answer is because he loves you, because he loves you. That's a circular argument. And in his sermon, he gives this example. He says, you know, imagine your wife comes up to you, right, to all the men, he says, and asks, "Why do you love me?" He says, at that point, what you say next matters. Everything is at stake, right? And so a man might say, "Well, I love you because you're beautiful and because you've got a great figure after all of these years. I love you because you are athletic and we can do great activities together. I love you because you are a career woman and you bring money into our family." And he says, if this woman is really, really stupid, she might for 1 minute think, "Huh, that's really flattering." But then she's going to soon realize, well, what if not? I'm not all of those things? You see, when you make your love contingent on something that you do or your performance, then inevitably you have to maintain those things in order to maintain that love. The only correct answer to your wife asking, "Why do you love me?" is, "I love you because I love you. Because I love you." That's the only right answer. And so in the same way, you know, when we try to take our self-worth or, you know, our self-concept from X, Y, or Z, then we're going to have to do anything and everything we can to maintain those things. And if there's something that contradicts that, we're going to essentially have to bury that information in order to maintain this view of ourselves that is not actually true. And what Clowney points out here is that, you know, God really isn't just giving us a principle. He actually gives us a person. You see, Saul wanted to be big in his own mind, even though he was little. But when God sent his son Jesus, he sent somebody who was truly powerful, who made himself little so that we could be little, so that we could admit that we are not great, and so that we could experience the grace of God. You see, God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace and exalts the humble. And so the offer is out to you. You know, God wants to meet you. He wants to be in your life. He wants to give you his grace. But the only way to do that is to see yourself correctly and to see yourself as little. That the only reason that he would ever approach you is because of his unmerited love and forgiveness. And finally, we escape because we're able to conform God's view of us with the way we see ourselves. You know, the problem is Saul viewed himself in a way that never conformed with God's view of him. You know, he saw himself as very small, but God says, I'm going to elevate you to the status of a king. And so he never accepted that. He never embraced that God, because he is a loving, sovereign God, is going to give grace to those who don't deserve it. Instead, he wanted to prove himself. He wanted to prove his worth. And so as we encounter God and he says, I love you because I love you, and I've given you an incredible status because of who I am, instead of staying in this place of insecurity and never dealing with that, we need to grow in this area and start to see ourselves the way that God sees us. Otherwise, we're going to turn out like Saul. We're going to stumble and fall and become disobedient to him, and ultimately, potentially meet a tragic end because we're not willing to deal with this insecurity in our lives and this fear. Okay, next week we're going to look at the story of David and Goliath. Yes, Lord, I think all of us struggle with insecurities and fears. These are ongoing issues that we have to deal with in our lives. But I pray that you can grow us and help us to be more confident in you, not in ourselves. And I pray, too, that knowing that you love us unconditionally, that you love us because you love us, is the basis for real security in our lives, not our performance, not what people think about us, not achieving whatever it is that we're aspiring to do, but that we know we can rest assured that who you are and what you've done for us is the basis for true security. And we thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.